Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've heard the grim statistics. One in every four women will experience domestic violence in her lifetime, and an estimated 1.3 million women are victims of physical assault by an intimate partner each year. Women attempting to leave increase their risk. Coming up later, we'll hear from the director of Choices, a safe haven for domestic abuse victims, and we'll talk to an OSU professor who has done groundbreaking research on why domestic violence victims change their minds and return to their abuser. First, we welcome Franklin County Sheriff Zach Scott. Sheriff Scott has been with the Franklin County Sheriff's Office since 1985 as an undercover investigator, SWAT team member, homicide detective, and community relations supervisor. He was appointed to serve out the remaining term of Sheriff Jim Carnes, who died in June. Welcome to the show, Sheriff.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Annie Murray. She is the director of the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit in the Columbus City Attorney's Office. She has 15 years' experience as a domestic violence prosecutor and has directed the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit since 2007. Welcome to the show, Annie.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you.
And I just want to correct something I said at the top of the hour. I mentioned was talking about the Jennifer Blake case. It occurred in July, not earlier this month. I confused it with another case, which just speaks to the sad situation we're facing, right, Sheriff?
That is correct.
There was an arrest warrant issued for Jack Blake, Jennifer Blake's husband, but it took 13 days for deputies to first try to serve the warrant at what turned out to be the wrong address. The warrant was still outstanding the day that Mrs. Blake was killed. Do we have any answers now about the delay in that case?
Seems to be there was a breakdown all the way around on this particular case. I'm not really sure why. Upon doing some research, I was able to find out that I guess the day that he was actually in court, apparently what I was told that the indictment was already had come through, and for some reason he did leave court that day. So why that occurred, I'm not really sure. The other reason that I guess we have this tragedy is because of just basically it's lack of manpower shortage. We have a unit that's that answers basically to the court system, that it gets warrants from the judges and stuff like that. And these guys go out and they have to answer these warrants as far as execute them and hunt down these guys. This particular time frame, they had several out-of-state warrants. They had to go and actually pick people up. They had in-state ones. When I say in-state, it means they may go to, they may have to go to Cuyahoga County. They could go to Hamilton County. And these are usually at least two-man teams that have to go and get these guys. They actually had to send one three-man team on an individual on some murder warrants, which was out of state. And I did some research to find out, where people were, and they were all tied up on these on those particular out-of-state, in-state trips, as well as we had, I think, that week 11 probate situations going on. So unfortunately, we were not able to execute that warrant in the timely manner that I would like to be able to obviously execute one. That's because of lack of manpower. We had two people retired. We had basically seven people. We got one tied up on a task force. So we got basically seven guys that are trying to run that whole unit as far as answer for the courts. And when they get all these out-of-state type situations, there's just no one here to do it. So I have been and am still in the process of working with the county commissioners to try to resolve this issue. And of course, it's a staffing issue and it's a manpower issue. So we're working to hope this tragedy never happens again.
My guest is Sheriff Zach Scott, Sheriff of Franklin County. Also with us is Annie Murray. She is Director of the Domestic Violence Unit at the City Attorney's Office. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the issue of domestic violence and how justice is carried out, how law enforcement manages these cases. We were specifically talking about the case of Jennifer Blake. She was killed by her husband in July, Jack Blake Jr. He eventually committed suicide himself later that day. Sheriff, when it comes to staffing issues, you said the unit was overwhelmed, and obviously with trips to serve warrants on defendants being held in jails outside of the county. And I was wondering why the cases of people who are already in custody, so these guys are, these other cases, they're already in custody somewhere, take precedence over those who are on the loose still.
Well, the problem you get is they are in custody, but we get mandated by law. They will send us notification, and they say if we don't appear by this certain time, they're going to release those people. So So it's not like they keep them in custody, you know, forever. They will kick them loose within, I think it's, depending on when we get the notice, within a 24-hour period or so. If we can say we want to keep that person, but if we don't show to get them, they will let those people go.
And when it comes to going to the county commissioners and talking about these staffing issues, is funding the primary problem, or is it just...
Absolutely. Funding is the primary. And that's, like I said, we're presently working with the county commissioners. We're trying to resolve those issues. I had some ideas. We've changed a little bit of a procedure. One of the procedures, we did not always, check different addresses through the LEED system. Since I've been in office like a month and a half. And so we're now presently going to be doing LEED systems, which we were not doing before.
Which is the statewide law enforcement.
Correct. It's the automated data system. And that's going to be done with all of our warrants, which wasn't done before. And we're also working on making sure that the supervisors are going to almost do a triage. They're going to start, both the sergeant and the corporal of the unit are going to be totally responsible for the handing out the warrants, where before guys would come in and they get the warrants and there would be a pile of them, the guys would grab them and they'd start working. Mm-hmm. I've changed that also.
Director Murray, the domestic violence unit in the city attorney's office was not involved in this case. How do you get involved in cases? What's the protocol?
Well, in this case, Jennifer Blake's, the charges that were against Jack Blake were felony charges, and the city attorney's office handles misdemeanor charges, so those where the penalty is 6 months or less. If the penalty is a felony 6 months or greater, it becomes the county prosecutor's bailiwick. So this was a county case. Most domestic violence charges, however, are filed as misdemeanors, and so our office handles over 5,000 domestic violence cases a year.
Why is it that most are filed as misdemeanors?
The domestic violence charge is a misdemeanor. What happened in Mrs. Blake's case is that there was a kidnapping that was involved in it as well that made it a felony. It's just by statute that knowingly causing physical harm to a family or household member is a misdemeanor of the first degree, unless that person has a prior record that against other family or household members or the same family or household member that can then make that a felony.
How many cases are you managing right now?
Our office handled, we prosecuted 5,200 cases last year. Our victim advocates helped over 6,000 domestic violence victims in Columbus. So we have an extremely heavy caseload.
Do you have a relationship with the county? Do you work with them when cases, you know, maybe somebody calls the city to file charges and you're like, well, no, this is wrong jurisdiction.
Absolutely.
But you know there might be some issues the county needs to know?
Yes, absolutely. We, in fact, meet with the county prosecutors every day, exactly on those cases that I just talked about, where somebody has a prior record where it gets filed as a misdemeanor, but we know because of the prior record or the facts in the case that it should be a felony. We meet with the county prosecutors to determine which ones should become a felony. So we work very closely with them.
Murray, how much has changed over? I've been covering the issue for 20 to more years than that. And in some ways, it feels like nothing changes, that women are still being killed by their partners of whatever. And it's the same kind of problems over and over again. But people like you weren't around 20 years ago either.
Well, I think that absolutely the problem hasn't gone away, and we, as much as we would all wish that it would, it has not. I will say, in the 15 years that I've been doing it, our community response has improved decidedly. My heart goes out to Mrs. Blake's family. It is a tragedy that I truly wish could be avoided, and we are all working toward that. I will say, I think in Franklin County, we work very closely, the prosecutor's office, the sheriff's office, the Columbus Police Department, choices you're going to hear from them. Mm-hmm. And so it is something that we are constantly fine-tuning so that we can help the victims. It is something that, unfortunately, things go so quickly and so badly. And so I think communication really is the key. And that's what the meeting on Friday is going to be about, is how do we improve that? So we're all on the same page. We're all working toward this end of stopping this.
Sheriff Scott, it sounds like you all do work together. And it makes you think that sometimes, no matter how good the system is, when somebody wants to kill another person and they're bound and determined to do it, it's pretty hard to stop them.
It is very difficult. difficult. And you're right, we do work together. We have a detective that's assigned solely to domestic violence and has meetings with city prosecutors and meetings with the county prosecutors. So we do work together. Here in Central Ohio, I know it's if you're not from other jurisdictions or see how other jurisdictions have worked, we're very fortunate here that all of our law enforcement leaders actually work very diligently to work together. And it's hard to, you know, from a civilian standpoint, other locations throughout the country, there's very much territorial issues, you know, people working in a bubble, things of that nature. We really don't do that here. We really try to support each other and give each other help anywhere we can and work together. So I'm very proud to be part of the leadership here in Franklin County. Of course, it doesn't, you know, take away from this tragedy that happened, but you are correct. If someone is bound and determined to kill someone, it is very difficult to be able to intervene in that type of situation, especially with a family member.
Given the way you all do work together so well, what's the summit going to be about on Friday? Why is it necessary, Sheriff?
I have not been invited, so I have no clue. I've
sorry
been asked
about
twice
that.
About this and said, you're going to be at this meeting? And I'm like, I checked with my chief of detectives, the chief of investigation. I said, did you get an invitation to this meeting? He's like, no. And I said, did Detective Floyd, who's in charge of domestic violence, he's like, no. And I was like, well, I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Well, neither did Sharon McCoy Reichard, so from Choices. So, you know, I guess not everybody. I don't know who handled the guest list, but Annie Murray, tell me if everybody's getting along and everybody's working together, why is a summit even necessary?
I think exactly what we were talking about before is the fine tuning. You know, this is something where information about the whereabouts of Mr. Blake was given to one agency. But because things happened so quickly, it was not given, passed on to the sheriff's office as quickly as it might have been. I think that that's part of what will be discussed at the summit in terms of, and addresses change all the time. You know, the victims are moving to try to get to safety, or the respondents or the defendants are being are moved out to because of protection orders or whatnot, and we just all have to work together to make sure that we are all on the same page. The hard thing, again, is because we are large agencies, because we deal with so many cases, we have to keep fighting to make sure that we are every minute keeping each other abreast.
You probably know after so many years in this line of work that the violence doesn't begin at the beginning of a marriage. It usually begins much sooner. It's something that's endemic in somebody's lifestyle, probably. Sheriff, what kind of funding is out there for nonviolence programs in schools from the sheriff's office? Is it anything that you work on, or Annie Murray, anything you work on, Sheriff?
We don't have any type of that type of specific training and funding. Most of that's going to be, like, you know, in the area of Choices, and I'm sure Annie can expound upon it much better than I can as far as what's available for the training. We do teach the DARE programs. We're being approached right now by Judge Paul Herbert to incorporate some of the training for our seventh graders who are, you know, a couple years away from possibly human trafficking. And when I'm talking about human trafficking, I'm talking about getting caught up in the world of prostitution. So there is some in our DARE programs. We are teaching some about violence, but not very specific to, I guess, what we need to as far as, like, those type of relationships.
Annie Murray?
There are programs. We are starting to realize more and more that younger people need to be educated about domestic violence. I think it came to a head with the Chris Brown and Rihanna situation a few years back, that it doesn't start when you're 18, it starts when you're much younger. The Coalition Against Family Violence has a juvenile task force where we are trying to find programs for young people, both for the victims and the offenders, because there are not anything of the sort right now. I know that Choices, you're going to talk to Sharon Reichard, they do go into the schools. The Coalition goes into the schools and tries to intervene. So it's a matter of funding, it's a matter of staffing, but definitely that is in the forefront of everyone's mind. That's where it's at. You need to reach them younger.
Thanks for joining us, Annie Murray.
Okay, thank you very much.
Annie Murray is Director of the Domestic Violence and Stalking Unit in the Columbus City Attorney's Office, and also Sheriff Zach Scott. Thanks for joining us, Sheriff.
My pleasure.
That's Sheriff Zach Scott of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office. Coming up, we're going to talk to a couple researchers. We're also going to talk to Sharon Reichard. She's Executive Director of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
89.7 FM is your source for NPR news and local news. Stay up to date with issues impacting life in Central Ohio. The award-winning WOSU News team keeps you connected to the community, and the Statehouse News Bureau has the latest in-depth coverage of state government. Listen to news from across the country and from our own backyard on 89.7 NPR News and streaming online at WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. 70 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunny skies and warming up to a high of 83 for today. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 61 degrees. Sunshine for tomorrow with a chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm and a high of 85. And be sure to stay with All Sides with Ann Fisher. Beginning at 11 o'clock, Congressman Pat Teaberry will join the show. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about domestic violence victims who try to leave their abusers, why it's so difficult for women to make the decision to leave, and why it is so dangerous when they do. Joining us now is Sharon Reichard. She's the director of Choices, a safe haven and support agency for victims of domestic violence in Central Ohio. Welcome to the show, Sharon.
Good morning, Ann. It's good to be here.
Sharon was formerly director of public service for Grove City and director of the Family Violence Prevention Center in the Ohio Office of Criminal Justice Services. She came out of retirement to become the director of Choices. Also joining us is Amy Bonamy. She is an associate professor in the Department of She is an associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at Ohio State University. Her research focuses on the health consequences of domestic violence and the intimacy dynamics that keep violent relationships intact. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Thank you, Ann.
Sharon, are domestic violence victims more or less likely to report abuse to police these days? Has anything changed, really, in terms of those statistics?
I think it has. Hopefully they are a little bit more inclined to call the police when things really get out of hand at home. The problem that we run into is it appears that we have been, maybe in the past, we've been a closely held secret. What we need to do at Choices and what we are doing, and of course this program helps us to do that, and that is to get the word out that there is help available. I think there are folks who are being abused that believe that if they call Choices, it means that they need shelter. That is not necessarily the case. There are certainly times when that becomes necessary, but we can help. We have our SOS counselors, which is something other than shelter. We can provide them with information when they call our hotline in terms of safety planning. There's many, many things that we can do short of shelter that can help people, but they have to call.
Why don't you give that number right now?
It is 614-224-4663.
Okay, and we'll post that number on our website at WOSU.org. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You can tweet us at Ann Fisher WOSU. So what has changed the most, say, over the last 20-odd years when, you know, they were working on this in the Ohio General Assembly, I know, 20-odd years ago? What has changed from where you sit?
From where I sit, going back to 1995 when I was hired by the state to set up a focus on family violence in Ohio. And that's the genesis of the Ohio Violence Prevention Center at the Ohio Office of Criminal Justice Services. What we saw then and what we see now, I think the significant difference is the level and severity of violence. I think that has increased. There are some who say it could be because of what the lack of civility in our society today. There are a variety of things, but we do know this. We know that when someone batters their wife or a significant other, that it's not caused by outside sources, if you will. I know we've we've been asked, you know, when it's really hot in the summer or when the economy goes south and does it get more violent? People don't become violent because of that. When they are battering a loved one, it is something that started way before that, and it is, it comes from them, from within. I mean, it's like, how do you handle your anger? And there's a certain amount of insecurity and things that are involved in that that cause them to strike out. It's not the weather, and it's not the economy.
Amy Bonomi, what are the dynamics then that we know? What are the pieces of the puzzle that we know of, even though assuming, of course, that it's different for everybody?
Well, one of the difficult, we'll be talking about this in the next segment, one of the difficult things for victims in these situations to leave the situation, one is they are often financially dependent on their perpetrator. They're highly emotionally connected. Sometimes there's sort of argument that there can't be love that exists in these relationships that are highly violent, highly severely violent. But in fact, in the conversations that we listen to between violent couples, love is talked about. So there's also the children's needs that are taken into consideration, always weighing what is in the best needs of my child. Do I want my child's father present for their period of growing up? And then I think for all victims, there's always a threat of future violence. So that keeps them tied to their abuser. So if they do try to leave, there is a threat for even more severe violence to occur if they leave.
And then there's the threat of violence against children and pets, for that matter, not to trivialize it, but that's often a big sign of problems.
Absolutely. And also threats of violence toward other family members and friends.
We're talking about the issue of domestic violence, I guess, circa 2011, if it's been with us forever. If you have a question or comment, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Victims, Sharon, from where you're at and from the work you're doing now, what do you do with the people at Choices to prepare them for the challenges of leaving an abuser? As Amy said, that's a hard thing to do, and there's a lot of reasons why.
Well, there's a variety of things. It depends upon the situation. Each one is personal to that individual that calls us. There is something that was said earlier, though, that I want to go back to also, and that is with children. Children learn what they live. And when a woman stays in a violent relationship because she wants her child to be raised, but, you know, wants the father present in that child's life, I think they need to consider what it's doing to that child. You know, maybe dad is just beating on mom and not the child, but that's what the child learns, that's how you handle your anger. And it's critical that that's not allowed to continue. So when we encourage people to call, if they call the hotline, depending upon what the situation is, again, we can talk to them about safety planning. We can talk to them about counseling, get them set up with one of our counselors, and we can do that in a safe and secure way that they don't have to be in fear of their batterer finding out.
An interesting thing, when I was going onto the website, going online to check out your website, warning pops up and it says, you know, be careful, your computer might not be secure, somebody could trace what lengths you've gone to. The same is true for phones. So many people are on cell phones now, and even our home phones can track recent calls.
Well, that's very true. So they need to be safe, and, you know, maybe it's using a neighbor's phone or a phone somewhere else when they do give us a call. But yes, we have had instances where the batterer has actually put a trace on the person that they are battering uses, because it's all about control. They want to be control. They want control of every aspect of that person's life.
Another issue is GPS devices.
Yes.
Tracing devices.
Yes,
that's
absolutely.
Very common, I know, in divorces and that kind of thing. But I just occurred to me that in these kind of situations, a real controlling person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those are all the issues. And you wonder why people don't leave their batterer, that it takes up to 7 times for them to absolutely leave their batterer. It's a lot about what she said in terms of, you know, the economics, the children. When you have been, in some cases where they have been completely controlled, It's very, very difficult to leave. And those are the ones that we usually end up bringing into our shelter when they, you know, because they don't have any other place to go.
Sherry in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just calling because I know, well, I had very minor experiences in my past and that thankfully aren't present anymore. But I know just how expensive like health care and beauty things are today. Is there a drop-off or somewhere I could put together like shampoos and things like that that I could bring to the shelter?
How can people help out Choices?
If they want to donate things, I would encourage them to call 224-7200. That is our administrative office. We do have a covert shelter. We don't give out the address of that, but donations can be brought to our administrative offices. So if you call, again, 224-7200, talk to the operator, you can find out how you can process any kind of donation you would like to give.
Okay.
Terrific. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call, Sherry. It's a good question. The number to call for if you want to donate, if you want to give donations, if you want to help out Choices is 224-7200. The number to call if you're seeking help from Choices is 224-4663. Of course, the area code is 614. And we'll post both of those numbers on our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for us, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Amy, we're going to get into your research more in the next segment, and we're going to hear some of these couples talking to each other over the phone. Talk a little bit more about how often children come into that exchange and how that works.
Children are often present during the couple's conversation. So what we'll talk about in the next segment is men who are detained for domestic violence or they're incarcerated for domestic violence and are making telephone calls to their victims. And during those conversations, in 98% of cases, children were present. And these were children typically under the age of 3. So overheard the dynamics, the violence that was being perpetrated over the phone. Sometimes the perpetrators, for example, would ask to talk to the couple's child and then say things like, did you know your mom's evil? I don't know why she put me in jail. Tell your mom she's evil. So really being brought into the violent dynamics themselves.
And how do you work, Sharon Reichert, at Choices with the children? How does that differ from, I mean, what kind of services do they get?
Well, we provide child care, if you will, with the children. But primarily our work is with the adults, is with the women. So we have an educational part. We were recently the International Jewish Women's Organization donated a little library for us at our shelter so that we have that set up. We have a tutor from the Columbus Public Schools that comes in and works with the children. But in terms of therapy, we do not provide therapy services for young children. We work with the mom.
Tom and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Something that I have not understood, and maybe your guests can clear it up. When there's a case of domestic violence in a family, the wife and the children seem to be the ones who have to leave and go to one of the facilities, and yet the husband remains in the home. And it seems to be a great disruption for the wife and especially the children. And yet, do you understand my question?
I do. Why is it that the woman's the one that's leaving? Amy?
Well, I would just add that from my perspective, having listened to these couples, the incredible level of trauma that the victim discusses during the calls, I would think remaining in the home would trigger a lot of trauma memories.
I guess, Tom, you're suggesting as opposed to why isn't he forced out?
And why isn't it the reverse, that the husband must leave and the family can wife and family can stay in the home?
Sharon?
Well, I would just say that if law enforcement is involved and in a violent situation, yes, they can take the husband, the batterer, out. But otherwise, it's generally the woman fleeing from that particular situation.
She's fleeing for her life.
She's fleeing for her life and for the life of her children. So she's the one that has to, you know, to leave unless she's brought in law enforcement and had him arrested.
Thank you, Tom, for that question. Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Charlotte.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a child of a domestic violence household back in the 60s. And fast forward, when I turn on TV today, I see wedding dress shows and I see crime process shows picking up pieces of bodies and forensics. What I don't see is anyone, you know, what programs are teaching girls today that you marry badly at your own peril? So what do you do to check out? What do you do to assess someone? How do you check in yourself that to be careful not to confuse being in sex with being in love? So that you don't get into an abusive situation to begin with.
It does seem like there's a dearth of that versus the Jersey Shore. Never watched it myself, but I've seen
I happened to go to a friend's and they said something about wedding dresses. Mm-hmm. A couple thousand bucks out there.
There's actually
the
a couple shows out there with wedding dresses.
You know, like, and I'm looking at, who cares? I mean, if your face is being turned into a punching bag, forget the dress. Focus on what's important.
Amy, would that help, do you think?
I think that there's some trouble in our popular culture of representations of what women's roles, what girls' roles should be in relationships. And often there's this idea that we should be passionate in our relationships and sustain whatever is sort of brought to us by our partner. And sometimes I think it's the media cast jealousy as being a positive thing in relationships. So if my boyfriend's jealous, it must mean he really cares about me, when in fact it's jealousy is a high red flag for future domestic violence.
I don't know about, and Charlotte, thank you for that call. I don't know about Charlotte's specific situation, but Sharon Reichard, at Choices, in your experience with the women that are forced to go there, is it necessarily that they married just somebody irrationally at some point in their life and they didn't know what they were getting into?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to believe that somebody would marry a person that beats them, you know, before the marriage. Why would they marry them? I think this is something that can be, you know, we've heard batterers be described as like Don Juans. I mean, this guy was, he just, you know, he wanted to be with me all the time and all of this. And they mistake that for love, and it's control. And so they don't know it before they marry him, but that's what they end up with. So, you know, and the other part of this is it made me think when with that last caller, teen dating violence has been on the rise since, again, back in the 90s, we began to look at teen dating violence. And you see so much of that today. Just look at what's going on in our society and what's happened very recently in the Columbus, Ohio area. And it's
prevalent.
Well, also,
people, a lot of people aren't getting married. They're just staying in long-term committed relationships, if you will. For like, marriage doesn't really have that much to do with anything anymore, does it, necessarily? I mean, are the people, Amy, that you studied in your research and you listened to, were they necessarily all married couples?
Not necessarily all married, but I agree with what she just said, that often the promise of marriage is sort of held out there as things will get better when we get married. We had a perpetrator who had beaten the victim 30 times in the head. She was hospitalized for 3 days. And in the conversations, he was saying, well, we just need to get away. We need to move to Kansas. We need to be in a place where our children can be in heaven on earth, you know, in the country. Well, he was basically setting up for a life of isolation for her and the children.
Exactly. Exactly.
We have an email from Angel. It's a question for Sharon from Choices. What if a woman doesn't know what number to call? Can women simply call 311 to be put in contact with an organization to help them? Many women do not want to call the police but need to quickly find a way to just leave or escape. So is 311 going to get you to Choices?
I'm sorry. I don't know what 311 is.
Well, that's kind of the clearinghouse for social service agencies.
I would imagine that they could get them directed to the right place, and if that right place is Choices, that's the reason to, again, and I say it over and over, is we need to get the number out, the 224-4663. That is the hotline. That is where they can get help, get going in the right direction, and get their lives back on track.
224-4663. We're going to post that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Right now, I want to read an email from Jan, make sure we get to all of our choices issues. She says, I have served on Choices Board, am an attorney and former teacher, and feel that there are many retired people like me who would be most happy to volunteer to teach awareness classes in schools or help pick up the slack in other areas if such an opportunity existed. In these days of declining funds, why don't more governmental agencies utilize this willing pool? I don't know if that's a question for either of you, but it's a good question, Jan. So thanks for that.
Yeah, it is a good question. One of the things that we're attempting to do right now is to put together a volunteer network at Choices. We have a lot of people that want to volunteer at our agency, and the primary criteria that we have, because there are a lot of survivors that want to, because it's like, been there, done that, no, I can help someone else, and that's wonderful, except they must have been a survivor for at least 2 years. They need to get past, their own victimization. So what we're working on right now is putting together a network where we can accept people for volunteering. I mean, we're dealing with people's lives. We right. can't just bring someone in and say, okay, go and do. I mean, they have to be properly trained. We have and it's a 5-day training, I might add. We have one coming up later this fall, that we are taking names for now. And if people want to get on that list,
should they call the administrative number?
They should call the administrative number, the 224-7200, and talk with the operator there and let them know that they would like to volunteer, and exactly if they have something particular in mind.
Sharon Reichert, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sharon Reichert is director of Choices. It's a safe haven and support agency for victims of domestic violence in Central Ohio. And again, that number, hotline number, is 224-4663. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your all-day NPR news station. Listen to local and national news all day, every day. And you can hear the best in classical music on Classical 101. Listen to your favorite composers 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. It's 89.7 NPR News and Classical 101 from WOSU Public Media. For more information, visit WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour 2 of All Sides begins with Congressman Pat Tiberi joining the show, and then the endgame for Libya and the future in Syria. Join us for more All Sides with Ann Fisher beginning at 11. And you can join WOSU for a Chefs in the City Ohio beer tasting in the historic Grandville Inn on September 14th. Local food hors d'oeuvres will be prepared with a selection of beers from 4 of Ohio's best breweries. Tickets go on sale this Friday morning at 10 a.m. for $45 each. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to reserve tickets. Sunny skies today and a high of 83 degrees, partly cloudy tonight, and a low of 61. Sunny skies for Wednesday with a chance of a pop-up shower, a high of 85. Clouds Wednesday night and a low of 69. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking with Amy Bonomi. She's an associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at Ohio State University. She has conducted groundbreaking research into the whys and wherefores of women who return to their abusers. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Before we get to the research, we're going to play some actual recordings from her research. But Amy, why don't you tell us a little bit, about what you did do?
Sure. So we conducted a study with 25 couples from a Washington State detention facility, and we studied their telephone conversations that were made by the perpetrator while he was being held in detention to the victim in the pre-prosecution period to really better understand what the couples were discussing that would influence the victim to recant or take back her story in court.
And had anything like this ever been done before?
This is the first time that audio recorded telephone conversations have been used to study this question.
Was it difficult to get access to them?
It was not difficult to get access to them. However, they are highly sensitive data, so there's a number of strict protections that are required through the human subjects application.
If you have a question or comment for Amy Bonomi, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm going to start out with an email from Jeannie, and then we'll move to that first cut. She says, many women don't even know that they need help. They believe that if their husband loses control, it's their own fault. They know this because the only person aware of the situation, their husband, is telling them it's the woman's fault. I've been free since 1985 after 11 years of abuse, both emotional and physical. The emotional is the worst. We need to let women know that the violence always escalates eventually until he kills you. The victim thinks she can fix the situation. She needs to be told she can't, no matter how long she's been managing. He will kill her. His controlling behavior will kill her. Our society still tells us that single parents are bad parents. We need to change the message to single parents are better than abused and abusing parents. So let's listen to that first cut. The step one, the discussion of the abuse event.
Why are you constantly beating on me, though?
I'm not constantly beating on you. You don't understand that you beat on me with words, and I can't defend myself.
But I don't hit you.
But hit me. You hit me so hard mentally. I'm a very fragile person mentally.
I would rather be verbally attacked.
I would never want to be verbally attacked in my state. It's always a defense, and then me get taken to the point where you get my level going over the flip side, and I lose it like the Incredible Hulk.
That first conversation includes a lot of anger between them. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what stage this is and what it means.
Right. So typically when the conversations between the couples begin, it includes a heated argument about what happened during the abuse event. And there's counter-resistance of each other's count. Typically in those early conversations, the victims start out with a sense of strong self-determination of defending herself. And then gradually over the course of the conversations, the perpetrator is successful in minimizing her account of what happened to be consistent with his own. And I was really happy to hear Jeannie's email because one of the most powerful strategies that perpetrators use in manipulating victims is making them believe like the abuse is their fault. And we heard that in that first clip by basically saying, she said, why are you beating on me? He said, why are you beat on me with words. You beat on me so hard. I'm so fragile mentally. I would never want to be beat on in my state. So successful repetition of that particular segment in that conversation made the victim ultimately believe like the abuse was her fault.
Yes. I mean, the idea of calling himself fragile was kind of shocking. Does he believe it?
He absolutely believes it. Yeah, and it's a minimization of what happened is also an appeal to her sympathy, which we'll talk about in a minute. He's basically presenting himself as the victim, that he's fragile. She beat on him with words. He would never want to be beat on in his fragile state, et cetera. And then she was the one who pushed him to the point where he became the, quote, Incredible Hulk. And beat her up very severely, actually. She had broken bones. She was strangled to the point where she lost consciousness.
This next cut, it's where he begins to ask her to recant. Let's listen to that.
I'm going to the Supreme Court, okay. But you got to be there. You got to sit up front and you got to tell them that what you wrote on the police report was a lie, that you were just mad at me because you thought I was cheating on you with your cousin. If you say that, if you say that, they'll automatically let me go.
Okay.
All right?
Uh-huh.
You know I love you. Uh-huh. They might give you 5 to 10 days, but that's better than me doing 60 to 90.
Me?
Yeah, but that's better than me doing 60 to 90 days. They probably give you 5 days for filing a false police report. That's it.
I don't want to go to jail in 5 days.
Hey, I just spent 5 days in the hole. You can't do 5 days for me?
You know, when I listen to that, for one thing, you can hear there's a baby in the background.
Absolutely.
And, of course, this is a different couple. Mm-hmm. This is not the same couple. And so you saw patterns like this. These are classic examples of patterns you saw over and over and over again.
Right. Typically, this came later in the conversations. We call it stage four, where the perpetrator either asks or instructs her to recant. What we didn't hear is early on in the conversation, he started out by crying and saying how much he missed the victim, which is a feigned attempt at sort of gaining her sympathy. He then immediately led into, I'm going to the Supreme Court tomorrow. You got to sit up front and say what you wrote in the report was a lie. For those of you who may not have caught what was happening, that he asked the victim to say she lied to police so that she would, in fact, do jail time instead of him. So the victim would, in fact, get 5 days for falsifying a police report so that he didn't have to spend 60 to 90 days in what he said in the hole. So that was another appeal to her sympathy of, you know, how poor the jail conditions are. He likens it to a hole.
What eventually happened to them, do you know? Did she eventually recant?
She did recant.
And even though we know what actually happened and that she wasn't lying, they have to accept whatever she does. The courts do.
The courts do. Many states have what's called victimless prosecution, so they can move forward with a prosecution effort without the participation of the victim. But having the statement from the victim about what happened is helpful in moving that prosecution forward.
My guest is Amy Bonomi. She is an associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at OSU. Her research is groundbreaking. It focuses on the health consequences of domestic violence and the dynamics that keep violent relationships intact. And it's based on several actual conversations between victims and their abusers. So give us a call if you have a question for Amy, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So this final sound clip, it's the sympathy appeal. It demonstrates a sympathy appeal. Let's listen to it.
I don't want these.
I know, baby. My house, is it really, really bad in there?
Terrible bad. Yeah, that's why I haven't been able to call you. I broke down yesterday, an anxiety attack yesterday, and they put me in the psych ward.
What does that mean?
The psych ward? Where suicide people go.
So you're trying to kill yourself?
No. I just freaked out, man. Getting up every day in the same hole, I mean, without being able to talk to my family.
So what happened there? What was going on there? And was it working?
That is a classic example of what we call a sympathy appeal. And typically that'll come in stage two after they've had a heated argument about the abuse event. And the perpetrator starts in with minimization and sympathy appeals. Now, what we saw in that particular segment, or heard in that particular segment, he started off by crying, saying he missed her, saying it was hell bad being, quote, in the hole in jail. So he's describing how much he was suffering from being in the jail itself. And then also saying that he missed being able to talk to her and the family. So conjuring up images of how much he missed her and their children. And it was successful with this couple. It was successful in all of the couples that we studied in manipulating the victim into recanting her story.
The statistics that we know of, something like 80%.
80% of victims recant.
What do you do with research like this now, Amy? What do you do and how can it be used going forward?
That's a fantastic question. So we hope to bring this model in and to work with victim advocates to help them teach victims how to defend against these sophisticated strategies that perpetrators are using. The common belief in many settings is that the perpetrator is threatening the victim with more violence, and that's the reason she's recanting. But our study shows that much more sophisticated emotional appeals are what's influencing the victim. So victim advocates know that this exists. Having this tool validated in the literature will further support the strong work that they've been doing for the past 20 years and help them in training victims on this issue.
And the sophistication of these appeals to the victims, it goes across socioeconomic levels. This isn't just reserved for, you know, the college degreed. It's across the board. But sophistication seems like an odd thing to call it. Do they even know what they're doing? I kind of wonder when I listen to these guys, they sound like they're believing what they're saying.
They absolutely believe what they're doing. They're very sophisticated criminals. You know, we don't tend to think of domestic violence perpetrators as criminals, but they are. And they are very sophisticated in manipulating and what we call tampering with their witness and to influencing them into helping them get out of jail.
We have a short email from John. He says, what can I do as a male to support a female in my life who has been the victim of abuse?
That is a great question, John. Thanks for sending it. One of the things that I always advise sort of friends and family members is to be courageous. Don't be afraid to ask the victim how she's doing in her life. You don't necessarily have to say, are you being abused? But how are things going in your life? How are things going in your relationship? Hey, do you want to have coffee sometime? I'd love to chat with you. And sort of use a softer entry into the conversation as opposed to asking, are you abused?
You said you were going to talk to victims' advocates and people who treat victims and use the research to educate them. It could be pretty powerful for a victim to listen to this and say and hear themselves in it.
Absolutely, because what is so powerful is the perpetrators convince the victims that it's their fault, that the abuse is their fault. And having the perspective that every victim in the situation is experiencing this could be very powerful for individuals in the situation.
Did you interview the victims afterwards?
We have not interviewed the victims. That's the next step.
Okay. Well, Amy Bonomi, thank you for joining us today to talk about your research.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's Amy Bonomi. She's an associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at Ohio State University. We're talking about her research. It focuses on the health consequences of domestic violence and the intimacy dynamics that keep violent relationships intact. Earlier, we were talking to Sharon Reichard of the of Choices for Victims of Domestic Violence. I want to repeat those numbers right now. 224-4663 is the number for the hotline. And if you want to help, 224-7200. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.